Accession number 29954, Reel 6.
Eric Sanders, Reel 6. Now, we left the interview last time with you were working in London in the Blitz and had just, with the Pioneer Corps, and had just moved out to Wales. And this would be 1941.
Yes, but there is our first stop in Wales was outside Newport, Monmouthshire,
right,
where we were lumbering, working in the forest. That's also where we had a company band, and I was often playing till late at night, and then was allowed to lie in the next day. But I enjoyed lumbering, and it was whilst lumbering that I was looking down at the school. At the same time, I was doing a correspondence course, a Pitman's correspondence course, for London matriculation.
Mm.
I had suddenly discovered a desire to learn or study. It had taken a long time coming. I certainly hadn't been there when I was in Vienna. And I was really in love with studying. I was studying subjects, a subject I had never heard of before, economics. And I remember standing at the top of the hill where we were lumbering, and I was grating trees. I was taking the bark off them with a huge instrument called the grater, and then they were left to dry in the sun. It was very sunny, and I was looking down the village. There was a little school right down there, and I saw these little kids, and I watched them when I took a breather. That's when I decided to become a teacher, for entirely the wrong reasons. Not because I wanted to look after children and do wonderful things for them, but because I wanted to carry on studying. And I thought if I became a teacher, I'd be in the sort of atmosphere that would allow me to study all the time. Little did I know. And we were there for almost a year. And
was it the same kind of work that you were doing?
The whole of that year we were lumbering. We were received by an Australian officer who was in charge of the whole operation. The REs, road engineers, were doing the skilled work, cutting trees, although I was allowed by them occasionally to take part, join them, and that was a great thrill for me. But when he welcomed us, he told us that if we heard someone shout timber, we should run. And what I was cruelly finding very funny was that he stuttered. And I wrote a little tune afterwards, which was rather cruel. Luckily, the others found it so and didn't want to hear it. But it went something like, when you hear them calling, timber is falling, so stay around quickly away, for it's dangerous. Well, I enjoyed lumbering very much, and I enjoyed playing in the band, and I went to Newport every weekend to do my homework for the correspondence course. I had a very good time there. Then
where were you housed during that?
In a camp. It was probably newly built in Nissen huts, one section per Nissen hut. But what I remember most about that camp was a whole row. What do you call the toilets, military toilets?
Latrines.
It was one long latrine for about 12 men or so, and then we were in a row all the time, you know, and there were buckets underneath. And this is a bit indelicate, but I didn't like standing up and wiping myself, so I invented a method of wiping myself whilst remaining seated. And one chap called Benner said, oh, that's a good idea. And thereafter, my invention spread. with the exception of when the buckets were fairly full. That's when you wouldn't do that. And I remember once, on the many occasions where we were kept back in camp after having either for rehearsing with the band or the day, the morning after. And of course, officially, we were on fatigue. And once I had to carry those buckets to somewhere, I can't remember, must have been a sump or some kind of place, and one of them was terribly full, and it was, they're terribly heavy, they were huge, you know, and it was a very dangerous, slow walk. I remember, I shall never forget this. This was very close to going straight airway into me, and I didn't like I do. Well, that's Newport, but then...
Just one last question on that. What was morale like amongst...
Very good, I think. Very good. Very good.
Did you feel in any way out of the war at all? Or did you feel you were making...
No, we were... At that point, we were full. And Churchill had taken over, and we listened to his speeches. And I remember my diary writing, there was a real man. And... The whole country was being boosted up. The Nazis hadn't managed with their Blitz to sap the morale, and they probably, if they had invaded immediately after our evacuation, they might have done quite well. But no, we were all full of patriotism, not our fathers, but somebody else's father's country. And yes, there was a very good spirit there, yeah. And I may have mentioned this before, the wonderful wonderful environment of well-educated people in my heart, and I could ask people about things I was learning, and a good company. When we went out, we were visiting Cardiff or Newport every Saturday. I think it's Saturday, but yes, I think it was Saturday. Maybe it was Sunday. I'm not sure about this, but once at the weekend, I went out to Newport in the bus with my briefcase, walked to the canteen, had some refreshments, sat down in a corner and did my homework for the correspondence course, then had some more refreshments or played the piano in the canteen, which usually led to a crowd of soldiers and soldierines crowding around me and singing. Everybody sang the latest hits, and then I went to the cinema. And a girl who became a girlfriend later on told me that she'd seen me every week, and she wondered about this stupid, crazy soldier who was walking around with a briefcase through Newport, through the main street of Newport, with a briefcase. Then I was playing football regularly, and I got some varicose veins developing, and I had an operation in Newport. And then from there I was sent for convalescence to Abergavenny, and from there for total convalescence to Westward Ho, where there's a wonderful band every afternoon playing tunes. And when I came back, I told the sergeant major I didn't want to play in the band anymore, because my section and one other section were about to be sent to Carmarthen in deepest Wales on detachment. Just two sections, and he wanted to take me out of my section so that I could stay and play in the band, and I didn't want to play in the band anymore. I had got fed up with being asked to play the piano in the sergeant's mess. They were drunk, and they were not a very high caliber.
Were they British?
Yeah. Most of them. The non-British, they were beginning to have non-British NCOs, but they would normally not be at those parties. They were really... Look, I'm not being snobbish, but they were, and I had to play the piano, and they got annoyed, the sergeant major got annoyed when one or two of the girls rather stayed by my side and listened to the tunes, then danced with then fraternized with the getting more and more drunk partners who had invited them. I don't know. I don't remember every detail, but I do remember I got fed up with this, and I didn't want to do it anymore. And so I went on detachment to Carmarthen, where we built Nissen huts. A new camp was being enlarged, or a camp that existed was being enlarged into a very big camp, and we were building Nissen huts there. The engineers, again Royal Engineers in charge of the skilled labour, they built the bases. I remember helping to mix concrete. And then we had to erect those Nissen huts. It was a sort of fixed system. You had to put the upwards posts, the vertical posts, and then you had some going across at the top and in the middle, across and in the middle, and then these curved corrugated sheets were passed up to us, and we put them on. And we had very big nails, unusual nails with a sort of snail-like body, and we had to fasten these corrugated sheets onto the long ways purlins, they were called. Of course, you couldn't always see the purlin underneath. So sometimes when you banged your nail in, it missed it. The poor soldiers who were later on living there had little holes. But one on one side, the other. I remember a chap called Billy Hertzberg, who was a very humorous boy, my age, sitting up there saying, "Ah, caught you napping." He had managed to hit one into the purlin. And that caused so much laughter. We laughed at the slightest excuse. Now, it was when he and I were sitting up at the top of one of those corrugated iron sheets and hammering nails in, that a Swiss who had recently joined the detachment, and whose name was Hartmann, and nobody called him Hartmann as we would normally use each other's surname or first name, depending on how close we were. But everybody called him Mr. Hartmann, or in German, Herr Hartmann. I don't know why or how this came about. I suspect it started with the NCOs doing it and everyone else doing it. I have no idea, but somehow he was, of course, an elderly chap. He was 50 or more, although there were some of our chaps who were 50, but he was sort of very distingué. And he stood there and he suddenly said, "In the 87th company, some people have now joined the commanders." And I pricked up, because I was getting fed up with the Pioneer Corps. I'd really wanted to do something in an active unit. I had already once tried to be transferred to the Air Force, and they stopped all transfers. And I said, "Oh, how did they do that? Can you tell me more about it?" And he said, "No, that's all I can tell you," or something to that effect. And Billy Hasman said, "Don't be stupid. You don't want to go into the commanders. They wouldn't take you." And we started fighting each other in a kind of banter. And that was that. But several weeks later, this Herr Hartmann suddenly walked beside me and told me about a unit that was being formed, which was supposed to be go into action in ahead of the invading Allied armies. That's as far as he went. That's all the explanation I got.
Did he specify Austria or?
No, he didn't. He said, "Was I interested in joining such a unit?" But of course, it was a dangerous job. Well, I was very romantic, and I did want to get out of the Pioneer Corps, and I did want to do a dangerous job. I don't know whether I was being very realistic about that, but I know that that's how I felt. And I said, "Yes." And I said, "But can you prove? Have you any kind of identity?" I suddenly thought of asking. He said, "Well, I could, but I'm not going to." And I said, "Well, what do you want me to do if I say yes?" He said, "Well, just all I want is your name and address." So I thought, well, my name and address are no secret to anybody. It's not difficult to get my home address. And so I gave it to him. And he disappeared after another couple of weeks. And then a friend of mine, a chap called Faltychek, who was no youngster, he was 39 or 40, approached me and said, "Have you been approached by Mr. Hartmann?" We weren't supposed to talk to anyone about this, so I didn't. But he and I talked about it, and he said, "I don't really believe it. There's anything." I gave him my name, he said. I said, "I did." And to be honest, we both began to think there was nothing. Weeks went by. we came back from the detachment. From we were there for almost a year. It was a wonderful time too. The Welsh were extremely hospitable to soldiers. If I went for a walk on a Sunday, came through a village in the hills, there was always somebody who stood in there, come in, have a cup of tea. I made friends with a Belgian Belgian soldier, and we went together. I really had a very, very good time. I enjoyed the work too. I enjoyed the work at the camp, and I had a number of girlfriends. That was all part of the game, which I enjoyed. The part that I enjoyed, well, not always, because when sometimes friendships with girls don't work out well. And when that job was over, we went to Penarth, outside Swansea, but only for a very short time. And then I went on leave, and then we went to Sennybridge, which is outside Brecon. You know the area? Mm-hmm. A good way outside Brecon. And it was a desolate area. It's a huge camp, and that was all there was. There were a few houses, a street and a few houses. That was the village. Huge camp. There were Australians there who would not fraternize with us. I don't know whether intentionally or just didn't happen. But there was only one big canteen, so we were all together, but somehow or other we didn't mix with any of the others. Perhaps they were a bit suspicious of our foreign accents. They didn't realize they had a foreign accent too. And, well, after all, the difference between Australia and Austria is very small. Just L. And I remember going to celebrate that Billy Hertzberg's, birthday in Brecon. And we went out there on a Sunday, and we had agreed at which tea house we would meet. It was a little square there, it was a cinema, and we sat up there, and he hadn't turned up. So I said, I got fed up sitting there, and went outside into the square. I looked for him. I went outside in the square, and the strangest thing happened. I saw these people queuing up outside the cinema. And suddenly I was in the cinema. I had unconsciously joined the queue, paid for a ticket, and sat in the cinema. This is really true. And suddenly, what am I doing here? I rushed out, and Billy Hertzberg had just arrived, so nobody even noticed for a long time. It was a birthday party. But then I went on leave. Oh no, I went on leave for Christmas, but I also had to sit for my exam. It was the second time I'd failed the previous year, that matriculation, London University matriculation. So I had another exam in January 43, the end of, I think it was just after the 1st of January, something like that, and sat for the exam, and this time I felt I'd done quite well. But of course I didn't know the results. I came back and I had an almost mystical feeling that I wasn't supposed to come back anymore. And so the first day after my return to the camp, I went sick. I wasn't sick at all. And it was not surprising that the doctor put me on medicine and duty. That meant you were on duty, but you got some medicine. And the sergeant major, of course, realized I was just malingering, really. And he gave me the toughest job to do. I had to wash and sweep the whole of a foreyard, a kind of patio, but about four times the size of a normal patio. I had to sweep and scrub it. And the next day, I went out. We were to work. The work was building a road on top of the Brecon Beacon. I don't know if you've ever been on the Brecon Beacon, but at that time, at any rate, it was as bald as I shall be one day. there was no tree around there where we were working, not even a bush. And what we had to do was to dig a trench, which was going to be one side of this road. The road was meant to connect one side of the Brecon Beacon with another. And it was pouring with rain. And I got a sort of desperate into a sort of desperate mood, and I stood with my rubber boots in mud, almost reaching the top of my rubber boots, next to a corporal whose daughter had almost married, and we were both sort of in that same mood, pouring with rain all the time, and we were digging mud, wet mud out, and we were wet throughout. Over, and suddenly somebody came running, shouting to me, "Schwartz, you're supposed to go back to company. You weren't supposed to come out." And I had this odd feeling. I had a feeling that I shouldn't have come. A lorry came along, had picked up all the others, and I got in. We were fitted with entirely new outfits. I mean, kitted out with new outfits.
Still at base?
Still at, in Senebich, in the company HQ. You know, new uniform, everything new. I don't know whether they wanted to impress or whether they had been told they had to fit us out. We were given a railway warrant and we went to London.
Had you been told anything at the
bike? We were merely told that we would be met in London. I think it was Euston Station. It may have been Paddington or King's Cross. I'm not at all sure. I'd have to look up which train, which line went from Brecon to London. And arrived in London, a little man, I think he was a Captain Russell, never quite sure, picked us out. I don't know how he managed to pick us out, but perhaps he wasn't difficult. There were about six or seven. Seven of us took us on a bus for the and took us to Northumberland Avenue. Funnily enough, I now belong to a club which is on the other side of Northumberland Avenue, the Commonwealth Club. But on this was on the right hand side of Northumberland Avenue if you went down from Trafalgar Square. Only 100 yards or so, and there was a hotel. I think it was Victoria Hotel, I'm not quite sure. It was a big hotel. And I was so eager and so keen, I walked straight in through the door ahead of even the officer, and there was a tiny little lobby, and there was another door, and I stepped straight through that, and suddenly there was a bayonet in front of me, came shooting in front of me. It gave me a fright. This was the headquarters, or the recruiting headquarters, not the administrative headquarters of the SOE. And we were shown into a room upstairs, and one after the other was sent to another room. And when it was my turn, I came into this other room. It was a big room, and I was sitting down there, and there was a platform. I wonder why it was a platform, a bit like a school in those days. And behind that, behind a big table, sat a little man. He must have been very little, unless he had a huge lower body. He had a big face, big head, a bit like the pictures of Lord Beaverbrook I'd seen, you know, sort of full cheeks and everything. And he checked my name and asked me, "Are you prepared to do a dangerous job?" I said yes. He said, "Sign the paper beside you," and it was a it means that you must not speak to anybody about anything, and sent me back. And I think the same day we were taken to the station and arrived in Lys for our first training. There we met approximately the same number of people from the 87th company. We were 88.
Can you remember which ones of you were been selected, the names of the...
Well, actually, I have it in my memoirs, but I can remember most. From the 88 company, there was Schweiger. I said most, now I can't think of anybody. There was Schweiger...
Fred Warner, was he in your...
No, he was not there. Fred and Eric came much later. They came with a third lot when we were outside Northampton. No. Schweiger, Meyer. How odd. Have you got names? And I would probably remember if you can give me names. Or I can go and look it up. I think there was... what do you want?
Eric Sanders Reel, 7. Yes, the names of the people who you were with.
Georg Breuer, who became George Bryant later. There was Herman Faltichek, who became Hugh Fulton. I don't even remember calling him Hugh. There was Otto Kaminski. I think there was Koenig, who became Kelly. And there was Schweiger, Harry Schweiger. I'm not sure that he ever changed his name. He may have done, but I don't remember that he did. I think that's about it. There was another man who left very quickly. I can't remember his name, but he didn't stay. He was not found not suitable. And that was it. That makes six, doesn't it, with me? And there was I, of course, who became Eric Saunders. It was Ignaz Schwartz then, officially Eric Schwartz. Then there were people from the 87th Company, and they included Anderson. That is, his name was Helmut Fürst at the time. Then, now I don't know what Robert Beatty was called. Buston? I don't know what his German name was. I don't remember that, but Beatty, Billy Blake. Walter Freud, Herbert Fein, I think, was in that lot. Alan Grant, did I mention Yogi Maya before? He was in my lot, yes. And that's all. If there was anyone else, it was somebody who didn't stay. But we were a relative. Oh, Theo Neumann. Theo Neumann was in my lot. I'd forgotten him. Why? I'd forgotten him. It doesn't matter why.
But both companies, the selected group from both companies met up in Liss, is that right?
Met up in Liss, yes. So that other lot were obviously the people that Hartmann had spoken about. And he called it commandos. When we were recruited at that hotel, they told us we were in STS 1, number 1, which meant Special Training Schools number 1. And it, to a certain extent, probably that was the name given to those training schools. So that's where we are. We knew nothing about SOE. At least I certainly didn't. Some people in our unit knew earlier, much earlier than I did, but I don't know at what point anyone knew. And if we knew it was called SOE, we didn't know what it was. It wasn't until we were in Italy that I really got a general idea. And I listened to a discussion which made comparison between the SOE and the SAS. In Liss, we had our first set of training. Oh, you do want the details of training?
Yes,
I learned signalling. I did very well in signalling, probably because of my piano playing. Pistol shooting, field craft, radio science, basic radio technology and explanations. Funnily enough, we learned signalling first by sound. Da-di-da-di-da-di-da. We learned the Morse code, of course. I must stop saying
ah. Did you find the work, the training, challenging at this
point? I found it extremely encouraging, extremely uplifting. I was in my element. I was no longer the weak little boy I'd been in Vienna. I was quite strong. The Pioneer Corps, if it did nothing else, that physical work made you much stronger. And I was full of an adventure spirit. Again, probably unrealistic, but romantic, more romantic than anything else. But I did quite well. I was one of the quickest radio signalers. And I wasn't very good at shooting. But I wasn't bad either. We had no assault courses, I believe, at Liss. So that was all. It was a 3 weeks course, and then we went up to, then we were sent up to Arisaig.
Just go back to Liss. Was that a house at Liss, or was it a camp?
That was a little estate. It was a beautiful house, yes, of course. What was so wonderful? We were suddenly in real rooms with real beds, with people serving